Welcome to the Hospitality Forward podcast with listeners in more than 160 countries worldwide.
My name is Hannah Lee. I am president and founder of Hannah Lee Communications, an award-winning global PR agency specialized in hospitality and travel.
And I'm Michael Ann Stendick, editor-in-chief of Hannah Lee Communications, as well as the award-winning co-author of The Japanese Art of the Cocktail and The Food and Beverage Writer. Helping the community has always been part of our agency's mission. We understand that a lot of business owners, bartenders, chefs, sommeliers, and others might not have the resources to hire a PR agency. We believe everyone has a story to share, so we created our podcast where our listeners can get to know leading reporters and writers and start building relationships.
Each week, these top journalists from around the globe share their practical advice on how hospitality and travel industry professionals can be featured in their stories.
In fact, one of our loyal listeners got featured in the New York Times after listening to our podcast and following our media guest tips. So, you could be next. In addition, we give away a copy of our agency's book, The Japanese Art of the Cocktail, to a listener who shares how our podcast helped them tell their story to the media. Simply email us at hello@hannahleecommunications.com, have Hospitality Forward in the subject line, and share the tip that you learned. And now, on with the show. In this episode, we're delighted to chat with Sean Evans, a noted freelance writer who contributes to Whiskey Advocate, Fine Fair, Rob Report, and a wide array of prestigious outlets. He covers spirits, automotive, and longevity. Sean hones his writing and interviewing skills, interviewing thousands of celebrities, as a gossip columnist for the New York Daily News. Hi, Sean. Welcome to the show.
So nice to see you.
Hey, thanks so much for having me. Nice to see you guys.
So, Sean, let's start from the beginning. Tell us how you got into journalism and came to focus on spirits, automotive, and longevity. And also, is there a connection between these three topics?
Yeah, I do longevity because spirits and speed might kill me. So I got to figure out how to live longer to keep my vices going. I was a publicist, so I came from the realm of PR eons and eons ago, back when you used to have to fax journalists. I was working for Maxim magazine. I was doing their PR when it sold, and that left our agency without a job. So some of the people that I had been pitching were at the Daily News in New York, and they liked my style of writing. So they invited me to become a gossip columnist. So I spent years lurking in dark corners of bars and establishments, nightclubs, premiere parties, and whatnot around the world. Adjacent to that, a lot of the sponsors of those events and the premieres that I was going to were either liquor companies or automotive companies. So I got to know those communications folks really well. And really, I think I got into spirits because of a Johnny Walker tasting back in the early aughts. And I just found the way that they were able to break down all the tasting components was super interesting. And it kind of sparked a fascination with spirits. I'd up until that point, not even been a brown spirit person, but that quickly changed and I kind of fell in love with whiskey. So I started to try to figure out ways to write about that more, and ditto with cars. I attended some premiere and Jaguar invited me to go race a car after, and how do you say no to that? And I really like the dichotomy of talking about things that go extremely quickly, cars, and things that take a very long time to be just as awesome, spirits.
Currently, you write for several leading publications such as Whiskey Advocate, Rob Report, and Vine Pair. So can you tell us what topics you cover for each and how the audience of each publication differs?
So Whiskey Advocate, I'm typically covering things that are a little bit more reported out and feature-based, but I also do some reviews and some tastings and some explainers for them. The audience there is dominantly people who want to kind of tuck into an interesting corner of the whiskey verse. So some past stories have been about people who camp out for whiskey. So I went to Stranahan's in a distillery in Denver, Colorado, and braved, you know, 20 degree nights to interview some folks who had been waiting in line and literally camping in a tent on top of an asphalt pavement for 5 days just to get a bottle that's only at the distillery. For Rob Report, I cover a mix of automotive. So it's a lot of luxury car reviews for that audience. That audience is a little bit more affluent and achieved, high net worth. Right now, I'm actually driving a Lamborghini to write a story about the Lamborghini Huracan for them. And I also cover longevity because the billionaires that are kind of the celebrities in that space end up being extremely interested in living long enough to spend all of their money. So they're often investing and kind of poking at the boundaries of how we can live longer. And that's a really fascinating space to kind of cover. For VinePair, I end up doing a lot of either trend things, but also explainers. A recent story that we did for them was the rise of the barrel broker. A lot of companies coming on board to help companies find barrels that are unique for second finishes, but also, you know, the second fill or the first fill, or just offloading, you know, existing barrels. So that was interesting to cover.
So why don't we go circle back to your Whiskey Advocate story on people waiting online all night. I mean, we're really delighted to see this phenomenon thriving. I mean, it's almost like a tailgating phenomenon. So do you think that an experiential aspect is becoming more important for spirits brands today?
Yes, absolutely. Obviously, I was on the ground at Stranahan's. Garrison Brothers is a distillery down in Texas. They also do an annual release. They actually get people, there's two extremely wealthy patrons who bring helicopters and land in the field because they don't want to wait and park. So they fly in from different places. And now there's a note on the website that says, please don't fly your helicopter here. And we talked to Woodinville out in Seattle because they also do that. The through line throughout all of this is the camaraderie that ends up in this sense of community around a shared experience and a shared passion that comes out of the people who are willing to either sleep overnight in a tent or get up at 4 a.m. and drive an hour and a half to a distillery and then wait in line. So the sense of having an experience, sharing a glass with other people, kind of seems to be what the industry is all about in general, but they've figured out a nice way to own that in a way that a lot of traditional, you know, forced marketing kind of can't create those beautiful organic moments as one chief marketing officer goes, I couldn't create this demand if I tried. So that it happened organically is wonderful. If anybody gets the chance to go and kind of camp out for whiskey, I highly recommend it. A lot of people end up bringing really interesting pours and drams for annual. A lot of these are annual releases, so it's once a year at distillery only. So people will bring flights of past years and share those. So you can get to try interesting stuff, but you can also, you know, I met people who had driven from Florida. I met people who had driven from California. I met people who flew in from Maine. You know, so it really is this melting pot of enthusiasts.
What other trends in the whiskey world are you most excited about?
I think the death of the single barrel is probably near, and I think it'll get replaced by micro blending and micro batching. Everybody has a single barrel. When those came out, or when those kinds of programs started about 2010, it was relatively new. I wrote a story for Whiskey Advocate where I interviewed Ryan Mahoney from Julio's Liquors in Massachusetts. They were the first store contacted by Buffalo Trace and Sazerac to say, hey, why don't we, they were a great account. So they said, hey, why don't you come down and pick a barrel and you guys can sell it. And this is, you know, 2010. They went down there, they picked a barrel of Pappy Van Winkle 20 year. And Ryan, the owner, told me it gathered dust in his store for 2 years. He couldn't sell it. I think it was like $90. And at the time, no one wanted to pay a premium for bourbon. It was all about scotch. He said it just gathered dust. And I'm sure he has a few bottles in his basement, which he knows are probably worth more than $10,000 at this point. But from where we've evolved there's a lot of single barrels. MGP produces a high yield every year of single barrels on the market. Plenty of other places are doing single barrels. And you can either buy the new make and kind of sit on it, or you can go and pick a single barrel. That no longer seems to be enough for the market. So then it moved on to finishes. You know, we're seeing upwards of 14 different casks that liquid has to go through. But it's still the same distillate. You're still dealing largely with stuff that's made in Lawrenceburg, Indiana, and they're just trying to figure out how to make it bespoke, and because there's only, you know, maybe 11 mash bills that they're running. So the future seems to be either combining different single barrels into a blend or picking and launching single barrels as limited release bottles that are one-offs, like Rare Character is doing. And some of those are micro blended, some of those are micro batched. So I think that's definitely a trend.
We see a big future in different cask finishes for sure.
Exactly. So John, recently we read your Whiskey Advocate article that combines your two passions, cars and whiskey.
Yeah.
It was about, you know, British luxury cars collaborating with top whiskey brands. So do you see more of these collaborations in the future? And what do you think is driving this?
Disclaimer, speed and spirits only work in that order, not the inverse. For that reason, there's typically a reluctance, particularly around like North American car companies, to want to partner up or do innovative things with the spirit space because, you know, of the obvious implications of combining alcohol and automotive. The Brits, it seemed, don't have that same hang-up. They seem to like a tipple more. But, you know, when you talk about really high-end luxury things, whether that's cars or whatever, the people who gravitate towards buying the upper range of those kinds of things, you know, a lot of the times they're collectible. People do so for bragging rights. You want to show things off to your other friends about, you know, kind of what you're able to get. All of that holds true in the high-end liquor space, so particularly whiskey. So there's some natural collaborations. There's a lot, I think, from a marketing standpoint, the idea of craftsmanship is a strong corollary between whiskey and automotive. We did the last one that I was able to try was the Bentley Motors and the Macallan combined to make Horizon, which is a $50,000 bottle. It took them a year to be able to figure out how to get the closure on the bottle right, because they lay the bottle horizontally in the shroud. They use aluminum that's actually excess from when they make parts of the Bentley. They take that actual aluminum from the production line, and then they repurpose that into some of the bottles. The wood comes from the same regions and the same kinds of trees. It gets a similar treatment as it would in a Bentley. And then some of the copper in the bottle is actually from old Macallan stills that had been repurposed. Very bespoke, very unique, tasty, very tasty liquid. And I think you'll probably see more of that happening, only because much like in that, again, in that rarefied strata of I want the best and I want something that nobody else can have, that holds true for automotive and for whiskey. So I think we'll see some more of that in the future.
As a freelancer, where do you go for inspiration when coming up with story ideas?
Facebook. Largely, that is the biggest portal and hub and community and way to connect with people and find out what's rising or falling ahead of, you know, looking at like a Google Trends or a Google News. You can watch things start to surface. I think I'm in like 20 or 30 different Facebook groups that are whiskey based. Some that are based around a brand, some that are based around a mash bill, some that are based around a region. And from each of those, you can find a lot of fascinating stories. I spend a large amount of time writing about how Facebook is killing bourbon and killing whiskey, because there's a lot of bad actors. There's a lot of people who are passing bottles off as counterfeit. There's a lot of theft, you know, in terms of offering a bottle, but you don't actually own it. So you just take somebody's Venmo and you disappear.
Just to clarify, you're talking about Facebook Marketplace?
None of this happens on Facebook Marketplace. The bourbon secondary, well, the whiskey secondary market is dominantly bourbon. So it's pretty much the bourbon secondary market. It is spread out. I mean, there's probably hundreds and hundreds of groups. They have interesting names. It's private groups. You can post a bottle. You have to use a lot of emojis. You know, use a robot icon to represent bottle. So instead of saying bottle, which is now flagged by Facebook, use the robot icon. Instead of saying dollars, like, because if you want dollars, you'd use a deer. You can't use numbers, so you have to use the icons of the numbers. So you'll see robot, ISO, in search of deer icon, and then a number like the four, but it's the sticker, the little emoji of a four, and then, you know, whatever the price, they spell that out in stickers. You don't know these people. So you have, there's a whole separate Facebook group where you can go, and it's like a reference check. And you can say, hey, does anybody vouch for this person? Because sometimes these are like $5,000 bottles. And if you are confident in your purchase, you then move to DMs. The deal happens in a DM. You exchange shipping labels, and you find the person's Venmo, and then you send them money, and then you hope that they're legitimate and that you actually get shipped alcohol. And there's a whole separate group for when these deals go bad called Bourbon's Reasonable Magistrate, the People's Court. And it's a group of 22,000 individuals. It's like a kangaroo court, but you can bring cases against other people in that space and be like, well, this guy, here's my screenshots. I said I was going to buy this. Here's where I paid him. He did nothing. Help me out here. And that person's usually, if found, you know, we'll use air quotes, guilty. You know, they're banned. They're kicked out of certain groups. So it's the Wild West. There's a lot of bad that goes on there, but there's also a lot of good. And I pitched a story, and Whiskey Advocate graciously took it, about the good that comes out of Facebook. And the lead in that story was a gentleman who was in full kidney failure and needed a donation and could not find a donor, and also had no way of really tapping a larger community than his own personal one. So he turned to his local Facebook group, and the moderator found him a kidney from a woman. And they actually, it all shook out all through a Bourbon Facebook group. So there's good and interesting things that can come from Facebook. Also word of mouth. I go to a lot of events, and you end up talking to people who are kind of in the know, and you get a source here or there who gets to tell you a few tips, and then you can kind of go run those down. But my wife, you know, always air quotes when I go out, because she goes, oh, you're going to work. And I'm like, yeah, I'm going to drink whiskey. I'll probably end up with a story or two idea at the end of the night. So those are the two real main ways. And then, I have some sources that I call occasionally who are all around the country. And I say, hey, what do you love or hate right now?
So now let's get practical. What are some of your do's and don'ts that people should keep in mind when they are ready to pitch you?
I would say consider a longer lead time, because a lot of stuff is SEO based. So I get a lot of pitches for like St. Patrick's Day for like 4 days before, maybe a week before. I'm actually writing a St. Patrick's Day story in December, because it needs to go up and it needs to take some time to get into Google. I can update it right before St. Patrick's Day with a little bit of information, but the crux of that story is already fleshed and formed out 3 months in advance. So I would consider digital journalism no different than old school print journalism, where you have a very long lead time and require some serious runway to be able to get those stories up. Always looking for an interesting angle. I mean, I don't think that's probably anything too mind-blowing or earth-shattering. But it's also what I'm looking for usually is not the what or the who, but the how and the why. Personally, I end up clicking on when I'm just scrolling, you know, I don't click on stories that the head gives everything away. And if the whole idea of your pitch can be kind of explained in one headline, then there's no real need for the story. So what I'm looking for is the backstory, like, how did you do this? Why did you do this? You know, it's great that you did this, but let's focus on some of the ancillary things that I think kind of get lost in the wash. You know, we're in an era of either AI content or just a crush of people, journalists who are struggling to kind of keep up with the news, because there's a lot of news. So how you can transform that is by focusing on the different elements of a story. And I think how and why are probably two of the most important things.
Over the years, we've been very lucky to get to know you and worked on several stories together. But for those who don't have a working relationship with you yet, what are the best ways to start one?
Send me bottles of alcohol. I'm teasing, although that never hurts. I do think making personal touch points is always helpful. I do appreciate the people who spend the extra 2 minutes. This is what I used to do when I was a publicist. Spend the extra 2 minutes, go into your feed, you know, your muck rack, your portfolio page, your Instagram, your LinkedIn, whatever it is. Find something that's actually personally interesting to you and pull that out, because it's better than a blind pitch. I wouldn't say it works 100% of the time, but 90% of the time, if someone's like, I can tell that somebody's actually done, it's not a blind pitch. They've spent a few minutes trying to understand me and why they think that this story would be good for me. I will respond. It's not always a go, but I will at least respond. And from there, you know, even if that first story doesn't shake out, I'm more likely to respond to a future story idea. You know, because we've started a relationship. So to me, you know, don't just ramrod your ideas down everybody's throat and assume that the idea is good enough. Try to get to know the people that you're pitching. I also think if you're pitching blindly, get your point across in seven to eight words in the subject line, because 80% of this I read on my phone, as does everyone, and it truncates. So if I'm not hooked in the first few words, it's just, you know, then a week or two goes by, and then occasionally I'll go back and I'll be like, oh, wow, I probably should have responded to that one. That one seems interesting. But, you know, people who bury the lead, as it were, in the subject line, sometimes that gets lost in the shuffle.
So aside from Facebook, what social media channels do you find most effective for identifying sources or trend stories?
I like LinkedIn. I use LinkedIn a lot. It's a good way to figure out how I can get to a source if I don't know how to get to them directly. I use Instagram. I think there's a lot I follow. You know, media is moving more towards the creator industry, as it were. So some media people have become quote unquote, you know, influencers or creators in their own space. And I think some of those folks are doing really interesting content. A lot of it's trend focused. It's interesting to see what rises based on those algorithms, because those usually are a step. Instagram is usually a step ahead of like Google News, so you can see if something's taking off there. I don't use TikTok, but it is interesting to dive in there and see what kind of stuff is trending. You know, I think particularly in whiskey, it's an older, he was older, the demographic of a whiskey drinker, he was older, you know, but it is interesting because, you know, there's a huge problem within the wine and spirits world about attracting younger drinkers. There's more sober curious. There's a lot more NA options. And, you know, as those kinds of things continue, I think it's going to be interesting to see how a traditionally staid industry can evolve to kind of keep up with that. Some brands are doing it well, some are not.
What kind of content do you want to see more on Instagram from the whiskey brands?
Diversification of personalities within the field. I say this as a white man with a beard, but there's too many of us in the space. There needs to be more spotlight on diverse individuals within the field. You know, there's a lot of awesome female master blenders, master distillers. There's so many people coming out of the woodwork who are doing really great stuff. And I think they kind of get lost in the shuffle, unfortunately. And I would love to see more of a spotlight shown on them. I also would say the same thing in terms of the brands that are covered, right? Like everybody knows Pappy and Sazerac and Buffalo Trace. Everybody knows Four Roses. Everybody knows the majors, you know, but there's a lot of craft distillers and upstarts that are doing a really interesting or decent job and that are trying to innovate to set themselves apart. Sometimes they get drowned out in the noise. So I'd love to see some more focus on that, a little bit more inclusion.
We couldn't agree more.
So we call our podcast Hospitality Forward because we celebrate individuals and companies that are making an impact through innovation. So is there anyone or any organization you'd like to shout out?
I really love Flavien Dijsselbloem from Brandy Library. When I think of like quintessential hospitality, that guy gets it right. And I love going to the Brandy Library. You know, he could do a lot of things to maximize profits, but it would strangle the experience of being in that room and the idea of what enjoying a really nice dram is kind of all about, which is, you know, it's a more relaxing and luxurious experience. You know, he doesn't let people stand, even though he could probably double his profits if he let, you know, people pack the house, but he doesn't want you. He wants you to sit in a chair and enjoy a whiskey. He doesn't want somebody's butt in your face, you know, because they're at the bar waiting. So I think he does a really good job of hospitality. I'm exceptionally excited. I think he's gearing up to open up a place in Midtown. I love a gentleman named Beau Dubois. He's a vice president of Bar and Spirits for two restaurants out in San Diego. One is Mexican themed, Eat Puesto, and the other is Maurice Lajola, I believe. He's awesome. He bought a barrel of Weller Full Proof. He, as you know, they have to bottle it, then they ship it to you, but they also ship you the barrel. So at his restaurant in La Jolla, he got the barrel, he got the bottles, he took the bottles and put them back in the barrel, and he put the barrel outside. And the experience that he offered was you can come and thief out of, if you ordered the Weller Full Proof, you'd thief it with an actual whiskey thief out of the barrel in the restaurant, right into your glass. And never seen that done before. He finished that barrel, and now he's got a Blanton's barrel that he's doing the exact same thing with. It's another one of those things that, you know, you were mentioning before. It's an immersive experience. It puts you in the driver's seat a little bit. It's definitely unique. The flavor changes because obviously it's still whiskey interacting with wood. The climate, they're closer to the water. So, you know, it's not aging per se, but it is mellowing a little bit. So, and it's kind of cool to be at a restaurant and have a little bit of oak particulate floating in your drink and know that it just came because you just literally took it out of a barrel.
Yeah, we love Flavien. I mean, he's a legend, and you know, Brandy Library is such an institution.
It's a singular experience.
It is.
So, Sean, we know that you travel a lot. So what countries on your bucket list to visit and why?
Asia and Australia. I know Asia is not a country, but I'm kind of interested in that culture for a number of reasons. I really like the cuisine. My wife's East Asian, she's Indian. So getting to experience, you know, her culinary realm and what she grew up with is awesome. You know, I'm kind of just considering moving further east and exploring that. And a lot of interesting drinking cultures and you know, pockets of things to discover out there. Like we discovered when I was in India with my wife, I discovered Feni alcohol, which is alcohol distilled from cashews. It's only in Goa, only in one region. And it's got this anisey taste. It looks like a bottle of Listerine and it's plastic. And it can be a little abrasive if you get the wrong one, but finding little pockets around the world where there's like, ah, this is just indicative of our region and here it is and you've never heard of it. I love that. I feel like that happens a lot more, you know, in some far-flung Asian countries. Also would like to try Australia. Big fan of Starboard Whiskey and what they're doing because, you know, their location and geography accelerate the aging process so they can get a more matured product after 3 years, you know, than a lot of places in America can.
Speaking of libations, what's your favorite cocktail and why? And who do you like to share it with?
Paper Plane, all the way. We got into Paper Planes a while ago. I love an equal parts libation. It's perfect in winter. It's got enough of everything. If you do it with a whiskey, like it can go any way. You can make it spicy if you use a high cask strength rye. You can make it sweet if you go with a 90 proof corn or wheat whiskey. I'm writing a story currently for Whiskey Advocate. I got a group of friends into them at a wedding over the summer in Montreal. We tried 9 bars. We had a plane crawl flight across 9 different bars. And then I kept that going. So everywhere I go, I try to find a place and have a paper plane. My wife loves them. So always her. She, anytime I'm making cocktails, she's like, can I have a paper plane? Like to try with your client, William H. Macy. I feel like he would have some interesting thoughts to say about that. And would be able to wax poetic. I'd probably be really good with his Woody Creek rye too. And I'm trying to think who else. I enjoy drinking with Tomo, who owns Copper and Oak now. He used to be Flavian, a bartender at Library. Now he owns Copper and Oak. He's a former best whiskey bartender in the world, winner. That gentleman can fix a mean drink, so I'm always looking forward to his little riffs on those. So I like to drink with him.
What do you think the next It cocktail will be this year?
Ooh, there's something to the idea of measured consumption that might take off. I think that's been kind of like halvesies. I've seen some places starting to do those where, you know, there's either an option to take a regular spirit and use half of a NA version of that spirit, like Kentucky or the Ritual does a whiskey that's NA. And you do a halfsies where you put half of the, you know, full alcoholic spirit in and half of that. I think people who are into measured consumption, that's going to take off. But Dusty Cocktails, Dusty's having a moment. So people are sourcing all kinds of vintage. It's not just whiskey anymore. It's vintage everything. Seeing more places crop up with cocktails. You can almost specify a decade. I did that at an establishment in San Diego. I said, make me a Manhattan from the 1920s. And they could do that. They had like Punta Mets. They had a 1920s rye. It was wild. It was absolutely wild. And Canon does that in Seattle. $500 to $700 cocktails that are made completely exclusively with like pre-prohibition ingredients. Citrus aside, obviously. I think more people want what they will never be able to have again. And that is limited stuff that there's not going to be any more of.
Because it's real scarcity, not kind of manufactured.
Yep.
So, Sean, before we let you go, what is the best way for our listeners to reach you?
I have a farcical Instagram called Angry in Paradise, where it's just me taking photos of with an angry face instead of a smiling one. You'll see some recognizable faces on there. Also, a lot of cars and whatever I'm into. That's probably the best way. Or LinkedIn.
This was really a blast.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thanks so much. Thanks for the interesting questions and allowing me to talk. It's so cool to be on the other side of the question table.
There you go.
Thank you. I feel like we learned so much about whiskey overall. So thanks for the education.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Now that was a spirited chat with Sean. Now that you know what Sean is looking for, please feel free to reach out to him and introduce yourself. And don't forget to mention that you heard him on our Hospitality Forward podcast. If you found this episode helpful, please share it with your friends and colleagues. And be sure to subscribe and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your favorite shows. Also, for all media guests to date, you can find their information and episodes at our agency's website, www.hanaleecommunications.com.
Until then, join us as we move hospitality forward together.